welcome everyone to Taking Stock. Really excited today, September 2nd, to chat with Beyond Mythos, who has done a bevy of incredible and varied research into not only specific stocks online, but some of the activist investor mindset, and has unraveled, uncovered some really incredible trends that I'm looking forward to learning more about. And he's posting all that stuff also in his X community for anyone who wants to follow along and kind of familiarize themselves with his research. I'll go ahead and share that link in the Nest right now. And welcome, Beyond Mythos, to the show. I'm so glad to speak with you today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Charles.
Yeah, of course. So maybe we can just get started, for anyone who might not already be familiar with some of your recent work, some of your activities online. Could you tell just a bit about yourself and how you got involved with this and what you've been up to?
Yeah, sure. Just a short introduction. So I actually joined Wall Street Bets in 2021 January when Musk tweeted about GameStonk, and I even didn't know GameStop, to be honest, before. and I was like, okay, there's a pretty high short interest there, why not get invested and throw some money at it. I had lots of Tesla shares, thanks God, before, and I shifted some of the portfolio, and you guys all know it, they shut down the buy button, and I was like, what is happening here? I listened to the house meetings later on and dug deeper, tried to understand a lot of the market mechanics. I was feeling I know nothing about stocks. In 2020, I was okay, it's everything easy, I know how it works. And later I learned, if you, for example, if you trade in the EU, you normally don't trade, you trade derivatives, not for example, the Tesla ticker, it's TLO. You trade TLO and you think you own Tesla. And I tried to vote, in 2021 for the first time for GameStop and also for Tesla. And the banks and the brokers didn't let me vote. And I was trying other brokers, and everywhere the same problem. Beside Interactive Brokers, they were really good. And then I learned about DRS, and yeah, I love you. I love your work, Charles, all of the DS crew. It's an amazing resource, DS, GME, YDRS, these are incredible. And I also joined the Reddit for DS, GME. I tried to dig into everything about the market mechanics, to learn about it, counterfeiting stocks, and much more about later on about censorship. And yeah, and then it bothered me because we were always looking at market mechanics, and Ryan Cohen was so much talking about corporate overpaid executives and overpaid consultants and boards and stuff, and I felt I didn't know enough about it, so I began to dig into it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for explaining some of that, your story, kind of getting involved. I think a lot of folks have a similar story, where they think they have an idea, they have basic assumptions, right? And then for those that started to descend down the rabbit hole, learned that there was simply a lot that we did not know about the machinations of these markets. But I really appreciate kind of your wrapping into, yes, of course, so much of us, we've learned so much about these market mechanics, the DRS, ownership, entitlements, as you mentioned, in terms of EU trading. That's an incredible thing in its own that we've done some episodes on in the past. But you started the transition to kind of focusing on individual stocks, on individual boards, and trying to determine if they were acting in a responsible way and an equitable way for their shareholders. And that's kind of what, earlier this year, I really was amazed with some of the deep dives that you did into companies like Chewy, Big Lots, The really great stuff. What was the most BuzzFeed was a recent big one that seemed to blow up a bit. And I'm curious to hear Macy's. Yeah. So, I mean, we rattled off a bunch of items there, and of course, each one is so unique as opposed to the others. But I mean, you've got the best view, probably bird's eye wise, of, you know, looking at these different distinct cases. There are probably some similarities between them, some major outlier information. What are the items that stand out to you? And I just want to encourage folks again to check that link in the nest to a collation of all of Beyond's research so far. If you haven't already checked it out, it's great reads.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, actually, I was talking a lot with 6 days, 1 week. I guess lots of people here know him. And he's into many stocks, and I was like, my first thoughts were like I did some years ago. I did I just checked all the stocks for their fail to delivers, and I took the the ones with the most failure to deliver, like the 500 or 1,000 stocks, and I checked their volume, and I mapped it. I did a map, like in, I think in August 2022, and some month ago I was wondering how are they doing, are they still okay, and I found many of those tickers were gone, and I was discussing with 6 days. Some of the stocks, and he mentioned some worth looking into in his opinion, and just like I think yesterday he sent me an article about Macy's, and they are like closing 150 stocks, and I think 1 or 2 months ago I did this DD about Macy's, and I found already they impaired 150 stores and now they are closing them. And also at the time I was like, they have a new CEO, what is he up to? The business looks just fine, and yeah, let's see where they're going, if they will be around in, I don't know, 1 year, 2 years. And I did some deep dives into all the companies you mentioned, and I found similarities, but also like companies being interestingly different, like costs, for example. My interpretation for costs would be they are heavily attacked from the market side, but internally doing okay. They are like they are not playing the tunneling out money and seller boxing game, I think. I'm not sure, but I think. But others, I would say there are clear signs. And when I did, like, I don't know, 5 to 10 companies, I was thinking, okay, there must be an easier way to get an overview over the broad market. So I took, I think, over 300 companies, compared their balance sheets and income statement and cash flow statements, tried to correlate them, and found like what I published is just, I think it's just the beginning, because there's way more. And I found an interesting correlation, like for example, for stock buybacks and what they spend on buybacks and the health of the company. So I think a stock doing buybacks, they're like in the first market, how did I call them? The activist investor market DD, right? I try to list a recent picture and try to list on the left side in the red corner. I try to list all these tickers being kind of suspicious, like they are buying back big chunks of their stock, and all their returns are negative. Like if you would do negative investments, which yielding negative returns, you would have a problem on the business side. And nobody's looking at stock buybacks from an economical perspective. So like if they buy back for billion or even more, tens of billion dollars stock, and the return on this buyback is like -50%, -90%. And this is actually where GameStop and BBVY were at the time. Ryan Cohen wrote the letter to the boards. They should be locked as they should be looked at as an like terrible investment, right? This should be stopped then. But they continue to buy back, and then I like tried to reverse engineer it and looked at what exactly happened to GME, like I published today, and what exactly happened to BBY. And I tried to outline the things most standing out is like normally a company is doing okay and then they are like buying back stocks. I won't go into the market dynamics, but they look pretty interesting because if you buy back stock, then the market is hyped. They lots of people buying in because they think the price will go up, right? And afterwards, the price goes down at some point of time, and this can like for some stocks like big, it's a decade. Like the price is going up and up and up, and they're buying stocks, and like as a retail investor, you can do just fine. But at some point, like normally the CEO changes, like you saw with GameStop or BBY with Mark Tritton, the CEO changes and he makes the company look terrible. He sells assets, increases buybacks or does some impairments. Like for example, I didn't look at impairments before with GameStop, but if you look at the graph, you see they like they were like, okay, we are doing a new strategy. We want to like we don't believe in the company anymore. We want to like it's all going to be digital, and we are selling stores, and we impair all the value of the company, and then suddenly your stock or the company looks pretty bad. So the price goes down, and then like. You empty your inventory. This happened also at both companies. And I think some of the companies also looked into, there's also a decline in inventory. So you like not a normal decline, like, I don't know, like 10% or something, but like 20, 30, GameStop 50 or BBY 50%. And then it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You make the company look bad. In reality, it's not bad. You could just stop impairing shit, stop buybacks, stop dividends, and maybe probably reduce compensation packages for executives. And then the company, the operations is doing just fine until the, let's say, very last moment before bankruptcy, when everything falls together, falls down, breaks, like everything breaks, and the company goes into bankruptcy. And also what I found interesting is like if you look at who's lending money, then it's JP Morgan, it's Bank of America. And I remember Roaring Kitty tweeting about Bank of America as an ATM, and maybe he hinted at this Bank of America actually lending GME money. And if you look at the rate they did, like they had, I think 10% in the last month or so. It's, yeah. I don't know if that's in the best interest of shareholders. It's not, and it's not. But nobody is complaining, right? Nobody is complaining, and I feel like the TD about GME. Like the retrospective perspective, we had GME timelines, but not what was actually happening inside the company. And if this is for the best of shareholders, and you can, if you read the post, you see it's clearly not. And I wonder how this can happen. And if you look at the other DDs, you will find similar things. And it's pretty often it looks like the same strategy, right? So you go in. Make the company look bad, you decrease inventory, customers won't be happy, probably also for GME, I found like they were pushing out inventory for like $5 a piece. I don't know what they pushed out. Like they said, 500 items and everything $5. But it looks like they were like actually reducing the inventory. Maybe losing money. Try to tunnel out assets and money. Like I said, like assets, for example, it seems to be like a good game to sell companies. And for example, when I looked into BBY, I found that they never actually said how much Baby is worth in any of their filings, but they hyped it for for different values. So they gave different sales estimates, different growth estimates, and it kind of was confusing reading through what they published and what also from Bank of America an analyst published, and then what they later said. And I got the feeling Ryan was mocking the BBY board because he knew what was up, that they like tried to sell Baby for probably a good price, maybe also tricking other investors in this new spec merger, which would emerge later, and afterwards tunneling out the profit through buybacks and dividends and stuff.
Yeah, you've absolutely covered a ton of ground there. Let me see if I can sort of draw a lot of that together to a fine point. It sounds to me like you're looking at a variety of different companies and their leadership through perhaps an unusual lens for the modern day, thinking about what are, from an investing perspective, often thought of as positive for the price maneuvers, things like stock buybacks, to name a large one, where, maybe an investor thinks at the surface level that because a company is spending excess capital to decrease the float size, then that means the price is going to go up. What you've discovered, kind of thinking from a different perspective, if the company is choosing to spend that excess capital on something like a buyback, then that is what that's not doing is increasing the company's ability to leverage its assets. It's not a growth mindset. It's purely operating from a perspective like with the ticker first. And that is ultimately, maybe that's good for people with millions and millions of shares, but it's borne out that in the medium or perhaps long term, based on some of your deep dives and research, it doesn't really pan out for retail shareholders that are trying to stay with the company and to see a development in their asset value. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And it looks like if you look at the volume traded, it would be normally you would reduce the total shares outstanding and the price would go up and you would have kind of normal trading behavior. But instead, maybe the price doesn't go up as much as it should be given the demand which is on the market, but they just like the volume goes crazy. But the price doesn't go crazy. It just increases some way, and then afterwards it kind of drops. For some company it takes a long time looking at big. For some companies, for example, looking at BuzzFeed or so, you have just a few months. I think the time interval there was like 3-4 months until the price went back down. I think it's depending on where in its life cycle the company is, right? I began to look at it as kind of looks like they have kind of cash cows, so they like milk them over decades or years, and some are just a short pump. I'm pretty curious how, for example, ASTS will turn out, like this satellite to phone company competing with SpaceX. I'm pretty curious how this will turn out, since their recent increase in from $5 to $35 or so. Yeah, let's see.
So I'm just curious for some other thoughts, just kind of regarding the stock buybacks and some of this board action. So you mentioned that, I mean, if you think about it mathematically, if you decrease the float by X amount and demand is the same and investor fervor is the same, then you might expect for the price to go up by that same percentage amount to reflect, no change in market cap. But although that might be common wisdom, what about the amount of money that the company spends on that buyback? Because now that's no longer on their balance sheet. So wouldn't you expect for for it to equalize at a lower rate, kind of commensurate with whatever free cash flow was spent on that buyback? And does that bear out in your research, or is it more of a correction than that?
I think what's actually happening is that they buy back shares at possibly high prices, and so they like I don't know in which researches I actually published graphs, but I found like for example Warren Buffett did buybacks in 2020, right, when stock prices were down, really down, and he like bought back like crazy, and he spent I forgot the numbers, several billions. Other companies suspended their buyback. They could have bought every share, like every single share outstanding, but they waited until like probably 1.5 year later, and like used the cash they had then on their balance sheet to like buy back when the shares were up again, so buy back at a maximum price. And but the volume like is far greater than what they buy back. So like there are maybe institutions, investors also buying in for this high price, and as the price declines afterwards, this is much value for short sellers. Look, like for example, this mining company, I forgot the ticker AMC bought into. I found this one really interesting because they issued new shares, so they did the opposite, and they issued the shares, and then the price went up, and there was also big volume, but actually they like earned 40x, 14x, or even more, less than the average weighted short price would have suggested. And I was like, who's pocketing in this difference, right? So someone is there on the market side taking the premium and accumulating cash.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting to think that there could be there are folks that maybe catch wind or are watching these developments and are able to capitalize on how these different actions from boards can affect the share price. And to that end, that's a perfect segue into something else I wanted to ask you. Have you thought or looked into much about how share buybacks were they've only been legal for about 40 years. Before 1982, they in America, they were considered market manipulation for that exact reason. You're undergoing a corporate action purely to affect stock price. How do you feel about that? Do you think that should be rolled back sometime?
Interesting. I didn't know they were illegal. I think without naked shorting, or without like if you like have a certain amount of stock which is allowed to be outstanding, that could be a good reason. And I also looked, for example, at Apple when Icahn went in and did a share buyback and issued a dividend. I think this was a good one in comparison to others, because like he was like he bought back the shares, so decreased the shares outstanding, then offered a dividend which was crazy high, and he needed to like pay less money for every share like supposedly outstanding. If you know like if you for example if you have like twice the total shares outstanding in brokerage account, right, you would have to double the amount spent on dividends. So someone has to come up for the like difference. So if you do this with a company like Apple, this pretty hurts someone, right? Someone has to come up with the money, and so you can you can indeed, if the company is doing well, you can use those tools to actually increase like shareholder welfare, I would say, and like punish shorts with this. I think this is what Carl did when he did this move with Apple. But awesome. If you have like, yeah, if you, I think that's a pretty good thing, but you need a company which is not run by overpaid executives, right?
Yeah, and just to give a bit more info there, for those who might not be aware conceptually of how that would work, if a company has 100 million shares outstanding and issues a dividend of $1, but it is common in the market today that there are more shares in terms of share entitlements being traded, then it's the parties responsible for having sold those entitlements or sold the shares, which then are represented by entitlements, to pay out that dividend. That's kind of what you're referring to. So that's interesting, Beyond, because I had not, I'm familiar with how that would work, but I had not heard of the idea that someone like our icon would have used that kind of strategy to intentionally and deliberately force a cash delivery from the from those short parties, whoever they might be.
Yeah, no, this is speculation, right?
I don't right, know. It's a theory. It's a theory. Yeah, I mean, right. The funny things about that are not to get too far afield, but just off the top of my head, a lot of, like, for example, Fidelity, like their USD in their accounts is represented by, what do they call it? Fcash, I think. I think it's something like that. But, who's to say that just wouldn't be delivered in the same way, right? I mean, I'm not convinced necessarily that shorts would be hurt by such a maneuver, but hey, who knows? Having more liabilities on your account is not going to be helpful for anybody. But let me go ahead and kind of move on then, because I'm curious to get to activist investing kind of in broad, because that's been so much more of a recent focus just in this last week for some of your most recent posts. And are you thinking then, just kind of to wrap it in a bow with the other items of discussion, that some of the prolonged board actions that you've been noticing, that you've been highlighting, do you think those are kind of like the, I don't know what the right phrase is, blood in the water maybe, for an activist investor who realizes that if they can get control of the board, maybe stop some of this style of corporate fund usage, like buybacks, like dividends, which aren't focused on bettering the company, and that is maybe the best route for their activist investing efforts? Is that kind of part of where you're coming from? And what else do you think are key indicators for prospective activist investors?
First, I think there are far too few Ryan Cohens out there. Like, I recognized Vivek, for example, going for BuzzFeed, but and Carl Icahn, of course, but I think there are not many activist investors, and there's a whole system fighting against activist investors, trying to avoid them. I found the lawsuit against BBY executives very telling. That's really interesting. And
if sorry to interrupt you, but maybe I wanted to ask, actually, before you get into that, would you define, like, what do you think of an activist investor as? Like, what does it mean to you? What does it mean in terms of specific actions that they might take? Just for anyone who might not know the term already.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I found that I think activist investment, like, maybe more easy than you think. It may be really harder than you think to kill a company, right? I was like, before I was thinking, okay, there's a bad board and they are like trashing the company and somehow it goes bankrupt and there's no way to stop it. But I found it's like, it's really the case that the company's like doing pretty well, even if there are bad executors at the top and doing all this stuff. But the company is still delivering, like, if you look deeply, you find positive cash flows and positive operating income. So I think activist investment, if you wouldn't have all the system fighting against you, would be pretty easy. You, like, you take a stake and you stop, like, just this those let's name it not business related matters like stock buybacks, dividends, and the stuff, and then the company delivers like positive cash flow and everything, and you can return the value to shareholders. Probably the market cap will rise again. So I think activist investment might be more easy as I looked into it. Of course, it's not easy because you have the system fighting against you, so you need lawyers and probably if you're doing this right, then you need like kind of protection for yourself and stuff. I think there are many people who don't like it, but in theory, it's just stopping this, and you could save a lot of companies. You could return the value to companies, and like the thing is, when Ryan Cohen stepped into GME or Bed Bath and Beyond, they looked pretty much dead from the outside, but they were pretty intact, I think. So he was like going in there, stopping all this bad shit. Like, just you could do activist investment, buy a 10% share or 9% or what have you, and just tell the board to stop. And you need to convince the board to stop. And as soon as you do it, the company will return profitable again and will be quite okay. For this example I mapped there, right? You have companies which are just shitty, and then of course you can't do anything as an activist investor. But for the companies which are profitable and just like try to bankrupt by overpaid executives, then it would be normally just to stop their, like, stop what they are doing, and then, yeah, that's it. And I think the second thing is shareholders, because I think there are like few shareholders recognizing what is going on and like also asking the companies to stop that, right? So, like, for example, you should look at every company which is buying back stock and ask yourself, do they yield a positive return or not? If they don't yield a positive return, you should ask them to stop. Maybe it's a first step for shareholders and also as an activist investor.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. Taking a serious critical appraisal of whether or not these buybacks and these other corporate actions are having, you know, good ROI. I wonder, though, and what do you think about, you know, do the boards take these actions because of a return on investment, or are there, like, do they make an argument, or do you sympathize with any argument that there are more intangible benefits to doing things like quarterly dividends or yearly buybacks? I mean, they're very common in our market space, especially among legacy companies, the blue chips, things like that. This sort of action is quite common and has become normal. How do you feel about that? How do you square that against, you know, when smaller companies, comparatively smaller companies, are trying to do the same thing?
Yeah, I think you need, like, for example, your cash position is pretty valuable, your liquidity. So as long as your liquidity is fine, you can do like dividends, for example. I think dividends are in itself are good. You return something to your shareholders. And like I explained on the example with Apple, as soon as someone shorted the company, he's responsible for the dividend. So like it hurts him or them. And like taking the example of buybacks, if you agree to the thesis that there are like possibly infinite shares outstanding, then why buy back any share, right? So like, beside the fact I just said, because like, for example, also taking Apple, if you buy back the shares, you can kind of leverage the dividend you give, if you think about it this way. But you should always be mindful of your liquidity, because most of the companies like Big or Macy's experience like running into trouble now, also have liquidity problems because like they used all their cash up, right?
Right. Now, some of that calculus changes when you have, I mean, for example, and think of the dividends or of the buybacks. I think both of these, the calculus changes somewhat when we have a developing interest in retail shareholders to hold directly with the company and so on. But of course, when someone like Ryan Cohen or someone like Carl Icahn were taking the actions that they took, there was no way that they could have known that there would be any kind of developing retail interest in this way. Do you think that does impact any of the decision making at this point, or these things are more bird's eye than that, and it's more about broader company fundamentals?
I think I think Ranko knows that there's a community watching him. I think he would probably he would love to have some friends going activist and investor style as soon as they like have the money to do so and have the kind of lawyer team and precedents. I think I wonder why there are not more activist investors these days, right? I actually wonder why this is the case. So I'm watching this closely, and I try to like think of what if MOAs would happen. And some of us just like get boring, you know, like then try to think of what can you do. You can like true, you can give money to people, but maybe you can also invest it into companies and make sure those companies prosper, right? So was it what you were asking, or did I miss the question?
Well, I guess in one part, I was thinking that, of course, when Ryan Cohen in the GameStop example decided to involve himself, that was before there was any directly held interest from retail shareholders that was meaningful, or at the least publicly disclosed in a way that he would have known about it, right? So it could not have possibly influenced his initial decision-making process. And I think you could probably say the same thing about BBBY, which is the other, recent known activist investor interest that he had, because they were not releasing any similar data, and this was before their bankruptcy filings that revealed the number of direct registered shareholders of or so. In that sense, right? I was thinking, would we expect his decision making regarding some of these tools to change as the amount of retail interest in terms of direct ownership changes, or do you perceive that there's not a big relationship between these two things?
First, I think when it's purely speculation, right? I think when Ryan entered GameStop, I think he saw the opportunity, like the post I did today. I think if you look at it's like there's so many things just wrong, so you can go there, go into there, make them right, and have a good company at the end. I think this was probably his approach when he went into GME. I think afterwards he recognized what a like large community and how many eyes he has on it. So I think his approach for BBY changed, and he tried to interact with the community. Also, he had this interview with GMEDD, right, where he hinted at several things. And I think direct ownership is very, very important. Like for example, like I said, in the EU, you're normally not trading like even the ticker. You're like trading a derivative, and this is, yeah. So you have no chance to play a role and vote at a company if you're not DRS your shares or go to brokers like interactive brokers who make it possible to vote or and make your voice heard. For example, sending company or proposals like going like make your voice heard as a shareholder. It's easier if you DRS your shares because you're like shareholder on the ledger. So I think those are important tools. I'm not sure how Ryan is, like he hinted at DRS several times. I think pretty likely he did. And I think also with like BBY shares, when BBY posted about register your baby gear with the manufacturer, I think this could be a hint at DRS. Like many DRS afterwards. Like I remember, PP Seeds like only doing DRS after this little picture was posted. And like for example, I forgot his name, the one from London. He was also like DRSing then like crazy after they posted it. So, but it went quiet. Yeah. So we have this delusion of GameStop shares, and there's not much beside like Ryan Kitty re-emerging this summer and stuff, but there's not much else which happened to DS, and I think it's kind of it's too quiet. So we will see if something happens, how DS will play out.
Yeah, true enough. And yeah, it's an entirely speculative perspective. I'm just curious for kind of your thoughts on it, since Ryan Cohen is in a unique situation there. Still, GME is in a unique situation in terms of this relationship with retail shareholders. Although, of course, at YDRS, we are actively interested to help other communities seek that kind of direct relationship. To kind of speak a bit more to, you were wondering before, just a moment ago, about why there aren't more activist investors, and I'd love to touch on that a bit further. And when you're thinking about why aren't there more activist investors, are you specifically thinking about like benevolent billionaires or wealthy individuals that are going to be able to meet the 5% thresholds for public filings, or the 10% thresholds to try to interact directly with boards? I mean, of course, in Ryan Cohen's case, he bought, 9%, right? And then sought to write to the boards directly in a public letter, which is another option people have. But not a lot of people have that kind of capital. They might be quietly accumulating, but, you're talking millions and millions of capital to tie up in that sort of way. Do you think that, is that part one? Do you think that's essentially the barrier that people just don't have that level of involvement and want to tie up that much capital? And then I am curious to ask you about activist investor groups afterwards, just as a thread. But what do you think first about the barrier of entry here?
Yeah, exactly. You have this barrier. There's no way around it if you don't have the cash or the money to, or funds in any way to have a meaningful stake to influence the board. Then you cannot, you cannot be an activist investor. That's right. So you need the money. That's true.
Yeah.
So this is why I highlighted also the shareholders, and maybe like hinting back then at DRS, for example, there was this case where the company went bankrupt, and I forgot the ticker, but as a shareholder at a broker, you have nearly no rights, right? While when you have DRS shares, you're on the ledger. You're some way up above shares held at a broker, but you can I think you can tell more about this than I can. And as a shareholder, you can still send proposals, make your voice heard, and also make other shareholders aware of what's happening. Like for example, if you are holding long-time shares at Macy's, and you're wondering what's going on, like looking into it, understanding it, and making other shareholders aware, I think that's a good start, and everyone, every little shareholder can do, right? Talking about it in social media, activist investor, true, you need some money, otherwise you cannot meaningfully.
I see. Yeah, you're making a great kind of semantic distinction there, where maybe traditionally the definition of activist investor that's been recognized in the established financial regime requires that huge amount of capital in order to directly influence the board. But you're absolutely right. I mean, an individual that is a direct registered holder can submit proposals and have them be publicly filed with the SEC and force a company response. They can communicate with the corporate secretary and get messages to the board in that way, in a way that is guaranteed. They can communicate on social media. And certainly all those are aspects of activist investing as well, just maybe not in the traditional, like clearly defined sense. And I really appreciate you mentioning that, because I think that's important for folks to embrace that it's absolutely, if you're passionate about one of your investments and you want for people to pay more attention to it, then participating or developing a community online is a brand new, modern, you know, cutting edge method that we have to communicate and work with each other, in a broad sense. So that's really terrific. You know, it's interesting because there's almost a bridge between these two ideas. I don't know if you've if you're familiar at all beyond with groups like Follow This, which are kind of they're broad activist groups, which are, you know, they kind of cropped up in the last 20 years or so. Most of them, especially Follow This, they have to do with green initiatives. What Follow This mostly does, you know, their members will buy shares of something like ExxonMobil, and then they'll collate together. Something you can do through the SEC is submit a proposal, not just as an individual, but as a group. And they'll submit proposals, like in Exxon's case, you know, that they need to meet certain, carbon emission standards, et cetera, for like the next year, things like this. And they're quite focused from that kind of perspective. They're one of the most successful, what I'd call activist investor groups, where, you know, rather than operating individually and rather than, needing to have that major capital as private parties, they signed together under, you know, larger banners. Have you looked into those much at all? And what do you think about that as an alternative avenue for influence and company change?
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Charles. No, I didn't know about them. I just opened a page from Follow This, and like they have the climate change as a topic, right? Yeah, absolutely. If you can create a platform, I think you need to check. Like, I never joined Wall Street Bets, I never would have thought that the whole platform is kind of compromised and censors in such an obvious way, like it does. And I think you need to be kind of like, who runs this platform and is it really open and what's the topic about it? So if we would find like Follow This for kind of activist investment regarding executives not doing the best for the company, then that would be great, right? And we have access to platform and maybe also like Discord channels and stuff where people can come together, talk about it, and do something as a group, right? But I didn't look at it, right?
Yeah, you're just seeing it now. And so that's definitely something to check out. There's a couple of similar groups like them as well. But what's interesting is that they cropped up, like I mentioned, some years ago. And as you said, just right there so eloquently, investors on communities like Discord or Twitter, these platforms that are openly available, they can self-organize into these same kind of groups and utilize these same kind of resources if they develop the drive to, and if they can be shown the way. That's definitely something, a future project for YDRS to try to provide the framework for any company to try to put together this kind of resource. But absolutely. So it's funny to think, Follow This, that's a centralized body, right, that is trying to organize investors. But there's no reason with modern social network tools that investors can't organize themselves and forego the central body and just seek to communicate with their company directly as investors. And that's really exciting to me. And I hope we can, in the coming years, see some strong development there and get some more board accountability and get some more pro-retail action in terms of how they operate.
Yeah, that would be great. Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, you've done some really great work just drawing attention to some of the bizarre choices that get made. And and I'm curious to hear, I know we're coming up close to the hour mark, but I'm curious to hear from you. What do you think the motivation comes from when it comes to the board actions, you know, that might be internally destructive in the medium and long terms, that might incite activist investors to become involved down the line? Why are these leadership groups acting in this way? Where does it come from? Is it a like a holdover from the business ed mindset? Is it some kind of influence from advisement groups that get hired out? What confluence of factors do you think might explain it?
Yeah, I just can't speculate. I'm not sure. If you look at like what's similar, I think a good starting point is to look at what is similar throughout all those companies. We look at, like, for example, who are the guys providing loans, who are the market makers, who are the consulting firms like BCG or so. I think all of them have kind of an agenda, and I don't know what you recognize is at most of those boards, they are like earning good money, especially when the companies go down, they're still earning great money. And yeah, that might, I don't know, that might help some board members to to make decisions which are not in the best interest of their shareholders. They should be aligned, right? They should hold like a big stake in the company. They should be compensated in stock, which is not only vested but also performance based. Like I found many compensation packages are kind of like at most restricted in time, so you just stay with the company some years and then you like get all the stock and then you sell it. And they're like many of those leaders don't, or leaders, overpaid executives I should say, they just like they don't keep their stock, they sell it, right? And that's much money.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate that answer. And I'm curious for your thoughts on, you know, one of the key things that you've said and is a perspective that I think is absolutely defensible in the context of your research, you know, but it's this perspective that the boards are not operating in the best interest of the shareholders. And of course, that's, you know, a direct breach of fiduciary duty. Pretty much the only job that they have is to operate in the best interest of their shareholders. And it's not like we're seeing anyone being directly litigated for that, you know, for that falsehood or for that fault through this kind of these kind of corporate actions. So do you perceive that it's a greater systemic issue? Do you perceive that the arguments that they might make, things like, you know, well, the stock price did go up in the short term just by a slightly less percentage, you know, things like that. I'm just curious for your thoughts about kind of the regime of thought on this and how far away you think it might be from where it should be.
Good question. I think like many of the excuses or reasons are more short-term based. For example, if you look at the BBY case and Mark Tritton and the guys say like, oh yeah, we want to like get rid of the money because we want to make sure there are no activist investors interested in the company because of the money there. And that's why we did buybacks and ridding all our cash while the company had a like already uprising liquidity issues, and that's okay for the system right now, and I think it shouldn't be okay. That's why I did my research, was based on like the last 10 years to see the broader picture. A lot of the things I uncovered and posted about are not, you cannot see if you just look at like 1 year or half a year. You see it like on a broader time frame, and there should like board should be held accountable for like the long term. And that's, I think that's also a reason why Ryan Cohen reiterates every time that he's manically focused on the long term, right? So it's not a short term guy. And that's, yeah, we need There needs to be a lot of changes, and I think Vivek said it, the rules are there, they're just not being enforced. So we have a problem in the enforcement there. And
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you on that as well. And it's just a developing familiarity that needs to continue among retail investors who are paying more and more attention to the exact minutia of how these boards are operating and how they've historically operated, what those what those outcomes have been. And your research is so key in helping people get a good grasp on that, and to help them ask the right questions when they, as they move forward, thinking about how they might want to invest and how they might want to keep holding their investments as boards continue to, well, either act one way or perhaps act another way, right? So that's all really terrific. And I just want to appreciate your coming on. It's been great speaking to you about this. Is there anything else that you'd want to bring up that we didn't cover already?
Yeah, first, thank you so much, Jive. I don't know if there are some questions from the audience or someone like having a question. I think we talked about a lot today. So if there are any questions,
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, if you've got a few minutes, if there's any questions, just raise a hand or request that speakership, and we'll get you right on up here. Would always love to hear from the community. That's the beauty of this platform.
That would be awesome. Yeah, right. Because like I also try to with the research, I try to make people curious and like hope to that more people dig into it. We do a lot of tinfoil in the community, and it's fun. But I feel like people should start digging more also into this filing, into what's going on there, and asking questions, engaging the discussion, and learning more about it like I do.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like inciting curiosity in folks. And that's really the most powerful trait that these investing communities can have, I think, is just to keep learning and to keep engaging. So, and if everyone is too shy to come up, hey, that's fine. But in that case, for any future listeners on Spotify or iTunes, any other podcast platforms, Beyond Mythos, I'll put your Twitter handle in the description as well. Is that the best way for people to reach out to you if they wanted to follow up?
Yeah, absolutely. Great.
All right. Yeah, it seems like folks are quiet. Nothing wrong with that. It means we were thorough, as I like to say, and really just wonderful speaking with you. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your evening over there.
Yeah, same. Have a great day, and thanks for having me. Bye.
Absolutely. All right. Bye, everyone. We'll catch you next week. Have a great rest of your holiday. Today is, I always get mixed, Labor Day, Memorial Day. Anyway, have a great day.
Labor Day.
I always mix them up. you know that. You're not even in America.
I looked it up because the exchange is closed, so.
Oh, you're like, oh, why is nothing trading? Yeah, it's a good day for research when we can't watch the ticker, right?
Exactly. Okay, have a great day, everyone. Bye.
Bye.